Right. Gotcha. Off you go, Patrick.
My name is Patrick. I'm a lovable guy, a person in recovery, and absolutely delighted to be at Tusnua today, sharing a bit with many of you I consider good friends. I was looking around the screen at how many of you I've asked to speak in Toronto, and it's certainly more than not, right? From Howard to David to Tom just shared about his 10,000 days on Thursday, so that was very cool. And if you haven't spoken there, and I do know you, maybe I'm coming for you, so be aware. Anyway, I'm so glad that so many of you say yes. I'm going to tell you a little bit about where I've come from and what happened to me and where I'm at today. So I'll do that in the kind of only way I know how to chronologically. I tend to speak a lot about self-worth because I believe that for me, there simply is nothing that matters more in my sobriety and my life than how I feel about myself. I remember having a sponsor who said exactly that to me. He said, "What could be more important than how I feel about myself?" I thought, well, lots of things could be. But you know what? Once I stopped to think about it, I can't be the partner I want to be, the son I want to be, the brother I want to be, if I'm not okay with me, you know, if it doesn't start at home. And it's why I introduced myself as a lovable guy, because for a long time, that just wasn't the case. You know, I came from alcoholism. My father was born just outside of Dublin in a place called Rathcoole. And he was a fun-loving, you know, singing, dancing, like to have a party kind of guy. But unfortunately, the responsibility side of life was not his forte. So we moved and we moved and we moved, and I ended up going to like 19 different schools just because of that moving. And again, we moved because we didn't pay the rent, you know. So that sort of childhood shame that started to set in, where I knew, you know, at first, of course, I don't have a clue what's going on. But once I realized that alcohol is playing this role, you know, my eyes are open. And it's funny, I often say this, but I remember my father wasn't a violent man, but one night he came home and he wanted a drink, and so he started tearing the kitchen apart wherever my mother had hid the housekeeping money in. And it was then that I saw this different side, you know. And I was, you know, I remember looking at my mother and saying, you know, never ever will that be me. I, you know, moved forward a few years, and that's the first time alcohol was offered to me. I didn't even blink an eye, didn't have any memory of that promise to mom or anything like it, you know. It's funny to me when we grow up, and say I, growing up in that situation, it's like, when I look back on it, I feel like there was a part of me that already knew that there could be something in that bottle for me, you know, whether it was, well, there was something for him. I loved him dearly, by the way. Don't get me wrong, that, you know, yes, we bounced around. Yes, there was a lot of horror that went with my childhood that I, many years in therapy and adult children, which, by the way, for me, as an alcoholic, I needed to take care of part one, you know, my side of the street, as they say. And certainly that was the primary purpose of my sobriety. Later on, it became absolutely imperative that I looked at stage two, was looking at the places I got hurt and where some patterns of how I did relationships, shall we say, began, and how I could repair them. But again, it went back to how I felt about myself. So anyway, we'll get back to that. So I mean, I was a happy-go-lucky kid. I was, you know, wanting to be loved by all, and you know, kind of develop that little nice guy personality. What do you need me to be? What is it that'll gain your acceptance and approval? Because what it is, that's who I'll be, you know. But it meant that I was an actor, you know. That's my smile that I brought to the world was one that was full of fear, anxiety. You know, as I say, from my really earliest recollections, I felt less than. I felt like, you know, other people, the captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs was a, you know, he was just a little bit better a human being than Patrick was, just innately, you know, and that's sad when I look back at that and see that sort of the childhood ripped from me, you know, because there just wasn't the pleasant parts of it that I think children deserve, you know. And I know it's okay for me to look back at that today. When I got sober, it was like, well, you know, you can't be blaming your parents for your alcoholism. Well, no, I'm not blaming my parents. I take responsibility for every drop I poured into myself. It doesn't mean that the examination of where I came from through the eyes of a young man aren't important to me. A young man, a boy, right? So as I say, that for me was where I found much of okayness with Patrick. Because again, if it wasn't when I was drinking, it was just that sense of shame. I remember, to give you an idea, I remember playing hockey out on the street. Of course, that's, I live in Canada, that's a big sport here. And my father came stumbling up the street, and we lived in an apartment building, and he stopped at the side of the building, and he started urinating on it, right? And I remember distinctly looking, and because of that Jekyll and Hyde, where we looked different and he looked different, of course, in this stupor, but obviously I never forgot it, you know. And to be playing hockey with the kids and have this happen, you know, this is not normal behavior for a 8-year-old, you know, to have to witness, right? So anyway, we move along. I get that opportunity to ingest some alcohol, and like I say, you know, the most god-awful stuff, this Canadian Sauterne, it was called, and we had that and this other horrific sherry, we called it Buck Five Come Alive, because a bottle of it, you know, two or three of us could get just absolutely howling on it. But getting it into your stomach, that was another chore entirely. That gives you an idea of what the taste was like of this foul nonsense. So, but I did it, you know, I got it down, and then the magic happened, of course, as so many of you describe, where everything that I'd been feeling, everything that I wanted to cover up seemed to be covered, you know, and I'd found it, I'd found the way through. And life changed in that moment, and not in a good way. Not in a good way. Alcoholism hit me immediately. There was no dipping my feet in the shallow end. It was full on. From the moment of that first drink and that first drunk, my life was consumed with how to get more of it, you know, and then later how to get drugs to add to the equation, right? And again, I look back, and a real sadness kind of goes on when I see the loss of schooling that I had, the loss of relationship with parents and others, because that focus and the self-centeredness of it all that goes with the disease of alcoholism, that's what I pursued, you know. By, you know, I was, excuse me, I was 13 when I first had a drink, and by 15 I was a daily drinker. You know, we had moved to Florida. Life was a lot different culturally. I felt really, really like an outsider, even though, I mean, you know, America and Canada are not so very different. But it was certainly different then. It was the height of busing. I you know, got sent to a school where, you know, just the integration was beginning to happen. And I wasn't used to such things. I'm not saying we are racism free in Canada, but compared to what was going on in the southern United States, we are. To the point I you know, I would come back and go to school here in Canada, and then go back to my parents. And I was just on this yo-yo back and forth between the two countries, drinking all the way, you know. And as I say, like, you know, school didn't matter at that point. I got through most of high school just based on the fact that, I don't know, I love to read. Thank God I love to read. My father had certainly instilled that one in me, so that carried me through without having to really do much, you know. I seemed to float through. But as I say, it consumed me totally, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time in it. I think you get the point. I mean, Drugs came into the equation and I just couldn't wait to get high. That was just another way, you know. But alcohol was certainly my drug of choice. Like I would take so many psychedelics and scare the shit out of myself that I'd go back to alcohol would never do that to me. Wouldn't make me feel like I was losing my mind. At least not yet, you know. So away we go. It continues on worse and worse and worse. And by the time I'm in my early 20s, my employers are sending me to treatment. I go to my first AA meeting in 1980. I don't listen to it. Like the guy at the front has had three wives and lost nine jobs and had 10 DUIs, and I could relate to none of this. So I didn't listen to what he was feeling and what was going on for him. I just was like, well, that's not me, you know, and away I would go. So it meant absolutely nothing. Then in 1985, I got into a really bad car accident, drunk. And I had to go retrieve that car from the wrecking yard. And when I saw, it was one of those little 1980 Honda Civics where they were made like tin back in the day. And the fact I got out of that car, just it scared the living shit out of me, let's put it that way. But it also, you know, some seeds had been planted along the way that I didn't see at the time, but they were seeds. You know, I often say I had a girlfriend at 17 who called me an alcoholic, and I just thought I need a new girlfriend. I didn't stop and go, geez, that's odd she would say that. No. Right. You know, my parents, my family members all were concerned for me from an early age, you know. So anyway, I get to a point where, you know, I've had this accident and something had happened there. My mother, of who, of course, like many mothers, would say her prayers for her boy. And she met a man in downtown Toronto that he was speaking on alcoholism and nutrition, right? And she approached him and said, can you help my son? You know, now my father had died of cancer, a horrific death, got sick when I was 18 and died when I was 21. And I felt like I had abandoned him. So I carried even more shame about that one. But I could, you know, it was easy for me to tell you what this man, his name was Joe Cushing, what he meant in my life. I had him as a sponsor for 19 years, and that was a remarkable relationship. You know, he taught me many things that I think my father would have really wanted for me, but was incapable in his own deal to pass on to me. You know, but my mother, I could never give her credit because she and I, you know, she would try to instill a bit of discipline in me, and I'd go to my dad because I could get my way with him, you know. So I could never really give her any credit for the fact that she, you know, walked up to this man, she asked for his card, she wanted this for her son, you know. So today I'm able to give her that credit. And as I say, when he died, instead of a mother and son, I was the only one at home. My siblings are much, much older than I am. Instead of us coming together, we went in two different directions, you know, and it wasn't until I came into the doors of AA that that relationship began to heal and to find anew, shall we say, right? Became very important to me. She and I had, you know, 10 or 12 good years before she passed, right? So anyway, I come into AA, and I'll tell you right now, traditional AA saved my life. It's just that simple, you know. But it also taught me to think, you know, it taught me to have an open mind. That seems to be one of the things that's talked about a lot. Well, I had an open mind. I was deathly loyal to traditional for the longest time. You know, my best friend had started a agnostic group in Toronto, and I would go to it and I would bring people I sponsored to it, but I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't make the leap, shall we say. So anyway, a little more about what went on in my early years. It seemed like everything I touched turned to gold. It really did. You know, the woman I'd been in love with since I'd met her, I met my partner the day we buried my father. And you know, that became a life-saving thing. It really did. We can talk about codependency and, you know, in partners and so on, but what that person, she's upstairs right now. We've been together 46 years now, and I love her like no other. It's that simple. She's my Joni. So anyway, everything I did, I got a great job. I got a couple of businesses as a result of that job. I was on top of the world, right? One day I got sick and I started to take over-the-counter cough syrup. No alcohol, no codeine, right? It's funny, my sister, whose birthday it was yesterday, she and I were just talking about this because she was relating it to her husband. And I should have been on top of the world at the time that this happened, but I wasn't emotionally there yet to carry the responsibility, the goodness of, I had more money than I'd ever had. I had the woman of my dreams, all of these things. But this cough syrup grabbed a hold of me and it went on for 3.5 years. I never picked up alcohol. I used to think, I got this money. Why the hell am I not doing cocaine? At least there's some good feeling in that. There isn't in this goddamn cough syrup. But it was just, an indicator of how I felt about myself at a deeper level. Now, again, this is my story. Many people come in, obviously, and they go along and never have, a relapse or a trip down any other roads. Well, I did. And it became as important a thing as has ever happened to me. I could not get rid of it. My sponsor stood by me, my friend Joe. It was very difficult for people in the program to be around me because it wasn't the type of thing where you're falling down, but it changed how you felt, of course, and it changed how you reacted to people. So it became a horrific time in my life. And again, one more time, I was isolated from the world, Again, great sadness in that for me. But I ended up in a place in Arizona, a couple of AA members that started this place, and they did a lot of childhood work, at what we refer to as adult child issues, codependency issues. That was their kind of specialty. And I spent 6 months there because I needed to. I had gone through such depression with this cough syrup because I would be off of it for 3 or 4 months and I never left the program. I fought, and struggled my way through it, but it would come back. And it wasn't going to end anytime soon, except the same way alcohol and drugs were going to end with me being dead, plain and simply. So anyway, I spent that time alone. It was a very, very challenging time to everything I did. I had to leave those businesses. I had to leave my partner. But something happened there. I found me, I was able to go to a place and purge anything that told me that I wasn't okay, that I was less than, that I was a piece of shit, especially with this cough syrup, because it was like I'd been given this new life through the program, all these people that supported me, and I just spit on it. Like, how sad is that? I take responsibility for taking it, but it's okay for me to see the sadness of what that looked like in life. And so the depression started, got to a point my sponsor was like, buddy, I think you need to go to the doctor and get some medication. And I did exactly that, and it carried me, as I say, into Arizona and that time I was able to touch things and places, get rid of deep held anger that I'd had as this little nice guy, I would purge in groups there, honestly, share things about, where I'd come from, to the point that I'd leave the group, I'd walk outside and I'd puke. And it was just hurt coming out of me, like from the deepest part of my being, but the good news is what was left was kind of okay. I had spent this time, and again, for my alcoholism, obviously it had worked for some years, where what I ingested, all of the positive things that are about working the steps and sharing with others, and for me, sponsorship, like I said, this relationship I had with this man was remarkable. I have a sponsor to this day. We sponsor each other. It's not like we need each other every day by any means, but we share with each other. When I need to feel heard, and that is one of my needs, a great need of mine is to feel heard, then I go to him and say, man, I need to be heard. and he listens. That's what it is, right? The guy who I had for all those years, he got sober in 1945. So if there was ever somebody who could have been, telling me this, that, and the other, it was him. He knew I had grown up in Catholic school, Catholic high school, and he himself was a devout Catholic. Not once in 19 years did he ever say, "Hey, Patty, you think you want to come back into the fold?" Not once. I didn't ask, and he didn't offer. And it was like that with the rest of the relationship too. If I needed his experience in something, then that's what he would give me. But advice was not in his, wheelhouse. All right. So anyway, like I say, this became a remarkable thing, and I came back from that experience changed, sold the businesses, was deathly afraid of school because I, again, had not never finished it, right? But decided that would be something that I'd like to take on. And it was wild because my sponsor's son was the dean of one of the local colleges here. And so a psychologist had approached him and said, we've got all these people that in the helping profession that are adult children of alcoholics themselves or of dysfunction, right? So they carry that into their work. So I've designed a program where I think can be very beneficial to those who work with them, right? So that's what this 2-year course was, working with adult children, right? And again, the first year was all about looking at your own shit. Well, I was fortunate that I didn't mention that my sponsor also happened to be an adult child therapist for many years, so that didn't hurt either. And that's the road I pursued. Not something I normally talk about, but because I don't think, my profession and my AA talk are two separate things. But I'm retired now, so I don't see it as a, anything wrong with it. But I began to learn, and then I started working with adult children, right? And it was fascinating because so many things that I heard in the rooms of AA, I now saw were just of the disease of alcoholism. People that had absolutely no problem with alcohol were telling me things and sharing feelings with me that were identical to what I'd heard in a discussion room in AA, So that was kind of an eye opener of how this thing permeates us, And there was a little expression, a guy named Ernie Larson was a guy whose work I really liked, and his kind of motto about work, about adult children in general, was, "What we live with, we learn. What we learn, we practice. What we practice, we become. And it has consequences. What we live with, we learn. What we learn, we practice. What we practice, we become." And boy, oh boy, did I know what that felt like, And I again, it always gets back to that same thing for me, that I have all kinds of things that I continue to work on in my life. I need to lose some weight. I've got high blood pressure, right? But I don't, when I look in the mirror in the morning, I don't go, "You son of a bitch, you got high blood pressure from your lifestyle." I can work on things and still look in the mirror and go, "You're a lovable guy again today." That's important to me because I know what the other story does to me. In spades, I know what that other story does. And there's nothing okay. Sometimes I wonder because I always introduce myself that way as a lovable guy. And it just doesn't matter to me if people are like, "Oh, buddy, with this lovable guy thing again." I could care less. I could care less. It's if one other person needs to hear that about being lovable, then I want to share that. But the most important thing is I'm sharing it with me on a daily basis, I found that purging the shit that was of my life has really, really helped me to do things like, again, the nice guy doesn't confront things. Today, I confront things. When something happens to me, I'm able to have a healthiness about saying, "When you did this, I felt this." If I have to do that with friends, family, then I have to do it, And I can take it the same way. That was never the case. I would resent something, and I'd resent you for my inability to tell you how I was feeling about an interaction we'd had, or something going on in our relationship. What else? Yeah, let me just talk about that for a minute, that relationship for me, and how it's new. You know, there's something that my partner and I, oh Jesus, how could I forget this? This is fantastic. You'll like this, I think. I like it. All of my learning what I was feeling, and this time that I spent both in therapy and then, you know, this intense therapy in Arizona, I come home. My partner, who also happens to be an adult child of an alcoholic, we're now having conversations, and I'm like, "So, how do you feel about that?" And she's like, "I don't know. Why are you asking?" And the point was, I was making her feel uncomfortable with this new, not just sharing my own, but now asking. So to her, it felt like I was trying to counsel her rather than find out. So anyway, my new need to know how she was feeling took us into couples therapy, and that was a fantastic thing because I learned something about what she needed that previously I just couldn't touch, you know? Like anything, you know, it's easy to do honeymoon in relationship, but what about when we're in discord? How do we do that? And for me, because I have such rejection issues, I want to talk it through, and I want to talk it through right now. And that's not how she processes. She wants to go over there and think about it a bit and be with it, right? And I have to go over there and chase her and ask her, you know, demand that she talk about it now. So I had this experience. We're going through counseling, and I didn't realize just how immersed in this need to break my rejection that would be happening in a difficulty in relationship, right? So my partner came home from work one day, and she was obviously out of sorts. And I was like, "Oh, let's talk about this." She's like, "Buddy, I just need some time with it. It's okay." We lived in an apartment in those days, so it was hard for her to go anywhere without me on top of her with the need to help. So she kept moving further away, ended up in the bedroom, and I said, "So what can I do to help you?" She said, "You can go away." And I was like, "There's no solution in go away." But I heard her. And I went in the other room, and I sat in a chair, and I thought of 57 different things that would help this. Because again, I'm in my deal. I need this fucking rejection to stop now. But I didn't. I resisted. You know, I almost needed to be tied to the chair to stop getting up with the new solution, right? She came out about a half an hour later, and she just looked at me and said, "Thank you." And I'm like, "For what? What did I do?" Well, I gave her the space to process that she needed, you know? So that began a whole new thing where, you know, she worked in law, and, you know, a lot of it was stressful, and, you know, it was accident stuff. So she was seeing these horrific pictures of people, you know, and some days she just needed to purge. So when we go for a walk, she didn't need Buddy to fix all the things that were going on at work for her. She's a big girl, much more responsible than me. She just needed me to listen. Imagine that. You know, but I'm telling you, in most of my relationships, when I take that approach, that I don't have to fix it, I don't have to do anything, I just have to help somebody feel heard. You know, if you phoned my phone right now, and you got the machine, it would say, "If you have a need to be heard like I do, I'm listening." And that's it, right? So that was there for years, and one day I was like, "Oh, okay, it's been years." So I took it off. Next thing, messages, hey, I got a need to be heard. That message is coming back, Buster." So I put it back. It's been there for decades, right? And I just love it because people will often, sometimes it'll be people who are calling from some other part of life, and they'll be like, "Oh, that's interesting." You know? So I kind of get a kick out of it. But anyway, and you know, I like usual, I'm kind of all over the place, and I could care less. This is, I guess, what I need to talk about today. And I have such a warm affection for this particular group. As I said, so many of you, I can look around and number you as friends. I see my friend there from Sligo that I had the great honor of spending some time with. as I did Tom. That's pretty cool. I'll finish with that. Just a word about, I finally, my friend was like, when COVID started, he's like, I had stopped going to meetings entirely. I just was done, you know. They'd stopped sort of providing what I needed from them, you know. I didn't need to judge it. I needed to step away. And anyway, so my buddy's like, well, why don't you know, there's Queen Street Mental Health meeting. Why don't you come? Right? I said, okay. All right. So I went for a couple of weeks, and around week two, our Mark here shows up from Ireland, and he's like, oh, we started this Secular Ireland meeting and we could use some support. So Joe and I were like, oh, we'll come. Well, I ended up joining that group, spending the next couple of years, and it started the journey of this whole Zoom and my participation in Secular AA. And I wish I would have talked about that a bit more, because that has been, it has rejuvenated my recovery, my AA life. This new discourse on addiction is fucking exciting, let's face it. My God, every meeting I go to, I don't have to hear the same old, same old. And again, as I said to you, traditional AA saved my life. That was there, now I'm here. You know, it taught me to be open-minded. I went to university, I went to college, I studied, you know, sociology and psychology, and that helped to open my mind as well. And although I always struggled with the God word, I certainly went down the road of higher power and that in my own steps in my own life. But then that got to a point where I saw that differently too, you know. I don't know if I probably lean more towards being an atheist this day, you know. I'll call myself an agnostic because I don't fucking know. What do I know, right? I just know that I don't have the same need for the HP side of things, right? I was fortunate to get to go to Ireland just after Howard, as a matter of fact, and followed in Howard's footsteps. It seemed like everyone I'd see, oh, Howard was here a couple of weeks ago, was cute as hell. You know, just to sit in Tom in Cork City in his shop and be looking at him, you know, face on, that's a fantastic experience. Then go up to Sligo, and my friend Don, who I've always been very fond of, and again, I don't know, it's almost surreal for me, you know. We had these screens and these years on Zoom, and then you're face to face. And any of you that are going to be in Florida, that's September 20th to the 22nd, and I so look forward to that. Like, wow, the gathering of these, you know, free thinking people is, I think, is going to be pretty special, right? Yeah, I went around the entire island, spent time with Eugene in Kinvara. I spent lots of time with my dear Mark there in Mullinavat. Mark was just here in Toronto a couple of times, so that was cool, right? But these things aren't to be missed for me, you know. The interaction with other human beings is at the top of my list, and there's some of my favorites right here in this room, you know. It's funny. God, here's Jeff and Ajax. I met Jeff about a month ago when Mark was here. Marcia, dear Marcia, lives 10 minutes from me. I'd never met her until, you know, a couple of weeks ago. Went to her house and had a lovely visit, you know. So just think, I'll get to meet Penny in real life. How fucking cool is that? Huh? How cool is that? So I hope to see a few others there. And thanks for letting me come into your living rooms and wherever today, and share a bit of my deal with you. Thank you.